Chairman and comrades, and I think I'll begin pushing at the very outset. The pamphlet is Marxism in the United States, which I think is the best presentation, analytical presentation of a Marxist analysis of both the New Deal, fascism, the entire period that we've been discussing from 1900 and from the end of the First World War to 1939. Now let's just have a resume of the earlier period that we covered in the first lecture on the development of the labor movement and pick out those high spots which signified the main element in the development and see how it was carried forward from that point. We began with World War I. There the officials of the labor movement, the American Federation of Labor, which was the only one in existence at the time, followed a policy of national unity, that is, subordinating the struggle, the class struggle, of the workers to the winning of the war. World War I, you know, was fought under the slogan of the war to end all wars and the war for democracy. And with the end of the war, the government became the spearhead of a strike-breaking campaign against the unions, which smashed most of the unions that had arisen during the period of the war when labor was scarce, and they followed a policy of tolerating the organization and existence of unions outside of the thin strata in the craft unions, the labor aristocracy. In the period from 1921, the first post-war recession, depression. Recession is a word that only came into common usage after World War II. The first post-war depression until the stock market crash, the period of the American plan of company unions, where the AFL was reduced to less than 2 million organized workers in the entire country. From 1933-34, with the impetus given to organization by the Section 7A, the New Deal, the social reform legislation of Roosevelt, a necessity to give the workers some concessions in exchange for the real genuine concessions that the government was granting to the capitalist class, there began the movement which culminated in the organization of the CIO. The character of the trade union movement in this period, from 1933-34, through the rise of the CIO and its organization up until 1937-38, the movement was characterized by the struggle for union recognition. And although ostensibly granted the right to organize by Section 7A of the National Labor Relations Act, the workers had to win the right in picket line struggle from one end of the country to another. Another significant development that should be noted in this period was that because it was necessary to organize all the workers in the a plant under the industrial form, the Negroes for the first time were enabled to enter into the labor movement through the new unions of the CIO. A previous policy of the AFL had been one of strictly enforcing a Jim Crow ban on the overwhelming majority of their unions, with the possible exception of the mine workers and maybe one or two others. There did exist the sleeping car porters, but that was a Negro union, confined entirely to Negro members. In 1937 was the economic downturn, and in 1939 the outbreak of the war. There was never any economic recovery until the outbreak of war. The New Deal failed to resuscitate capitalism, American capitalism, on a viable basis through all of its measures, short of the one that finally succeeded, the mobilization of the American economy for war, and then the final outbreak of the war in 1941 with the attack on Pearl Harbor. In the Second World War, the leaders of both the AFL-CIO followed a policy similar to that of the AFL in the First World War, that is, of national unity. In the Second World War, it was called the Equality of Sacrifice Program. But some of the leaders had learned some of the lessons of the First World War, and in exchange for the no-strike pledge, they had demanded and gotten a concession from the government in the form of maintenance of membership, a maintenance of membership clause, which provided that workers who were employed in the expanding war industries became members of the union. And through this device, the union membership doubled during the period of the war, and the labor movement emerged after the war larger, more powerful than ever before in the history of this country. And for the first time, there was established on American soil a genuine trade union movement. Now, the war period was not all beer and skittles for the workers. There were a lot of struggles. John L. Lewis led some very militant struggles during the period of the war, especially after he had fallen out with Roosevelt and the Roosevelt administration. And in the course of the war, and particularly toward its end, there developed a very strong movement against the no-strike pledge. Militants began to resist the imposition of the so-called Equality of Sacrifice program, which meant that the wages were frozen, according to the so-called Little Steel formula, but that prices which were supposed to be controlled under the Office of Price Administration didn't work so well, and the cost of living continued to rise throughout the entire period of the war, black marketing, rationing, and so forth and so on. And so the resistance grew to a considerable extent. The militants in the unions, especially in the mass production unions of the CIO, led by and large by radicals of one hue or another, were attracting more and more of the militants against the imposition of the restrictions imposed by the collaboration between the trade union leaders and the government through the instrumentality of the so-called tripartite board. Now, the tripartite board is based upon the concept of an identity of interest, that is, class collaboration, an identity of interest between the worker and the employer, with the government as the impartial agent representing the public. So you had equal representatives of the unions, equal representatives of the employer, and equal representatives from the government. And all decisions were supposed to be binding by this impartial tripartite board. Now, in 1945-46, with the end of the war, the union bureaucracy could no longer maintain its restraint upon the union. And there developed a tremendous post-war strike struggle, the biggest strike wave that this country had seen since the formation of the big organizing strikes of the CIO period. Prior to that time, the employers in this country had initiated a big campaign against the workers, intended to provide the basis for a repetition of what they had accomplished in the post-war one period. The workers, they said, were getting fat and sassy while the boys were over there dying for Roosevelt's four freedoms. They were getting exorbitant wages, living off of the fat of the land, so forth and so on. Propaganda calculated to drive a wedge between the returning servicemen and the organized workers here. As we discussed before, the returning servicemen in the period following World War I, together with Negroes recruited as strike breakers, proved to be a very effective instrument in smashing the union movement at that time. However, it didn't work. Concomitant with the developing strike wave here, there developed a movement in the army, in the armed forces, to bring the troops home. American imperialism had certain plans for cashing in on its wartime victory, which involved maintaining and using troops in the various theaters of war, particularly in the Pacific. And a tremendous movement developed against remaining in these areas once the war had concluded. Some of the leaders of this movement were prominent trade unionists. Emil Macy, emerged as a very prominent, I believe he was in the Philippine Islands at the time, a very prominent leader of the Bring the Boys Home movement. So that when the strike wave broke out, and when the employers launched their violently anti-union campaign, it received no response from the returning servicemen. On the contrary, they identified their interests with the striking workers. And in all instances, my memory serves me right, the workers emerged with very substantial gains from this strike wave. Now the employers learned a lesson. The lesson that they had learned was that the unions had grown so powerful, the development of union consciousness had become so widespread, that no longer was it possible for the employers, unaided, to challenge and housebreak or crush the union movement. And therefore, they turned once again, as so often in history, to the impartial agency which represents the public, the government, which we, of course, as Marxists, recognize as the executive committee of the ruling class. And in 1947, they enacted the Taft-Hartley Act, the first of the post-war series of anti-labor legislation. And the Taft-Hartley Act was designed to take away from the workers all of the advantages they had had in the incorporated in the previous Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act of the Roosevelt administration prior to the war, and to place them under a number of curbs, that is, to begin the process of encroaching upon the independence of the union, imposed many restrictions upon them, including the so-called non-communist oath. The reaction of the unions at the time was to characterize the act correctly as a slave labor law, and to engage in a campaign for its defeat, in which they failed. And later, some of the unions refused to accept the non-communist affidavit. The mine workers, the transport workers, the ITU, and the maritime workers, the NMU, a number of other unions refused to accept the to comply with the non-communist affidavit, and defied the act. It wasn't long, however, before some of the fakers began to break ranks. They didn't relish taking on the kind of a struggle with the government, which would be involved in carrying forward a an effective fight against Taft-Hartley, which would have to be conducted on a national scale. It would be of a political character. It would mean arousing a movement based upon the class struggle and destroying their coalition with the Democratic Party administration. And so a number of them broke ranks, signed the non-communist affidavit, and then one after another fell into line. Some of them carried court cases up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court substantially upheld the act, and since then it has been accepted more or less as a part of the status quo in management-labor relations. Now, Taft-Hartley although in its provisions constituted a union wrecking measure, it was not used for that purpose and hasn't been to this day with certain exceptions. It did not affect much the relations between the more powerful unions and the employers, and what it did do was to very effectively halt the expansion of union organization in this country. That is, by the use of Taft-Hartley, the employers could prevent, in the overwhelming majority of cases, the organization of workers who were unorganized. Taft-Hartley was supplemented by the right to work laws, which now have been enacted in 20 states, which further restricts both the ability of the unions to organize the unorganized workers and to conduct effective struggle for their demands. One of the factors that was in many ways decisive in deterring the union leaders from any effective struggle against Taft-Hartley was the outbreak of a Cold War in 1946 with the Churchill's Fulton, Missouri speech. There was ushered in the period of the Cold War, which exploded, blew the illusion, the fantasy that the Stalinists had disseminated after the end of the war, that all of the pacts made between Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt had eliminated the necessity for the class struggle, that had ensured a indefinite period of prosperity and peace, and they on that basis had, if you remember in our discussion, had advocated the permanent no-strike pledge to be read into the union contract. The Cold War blew that sky high. And there began the anti-communist crusades, 1946. In Taft-Hartley, it was exemplified by the anti-communist affidavit, which all unions had to sign in order to avail themselves of the provisions of Taft-Hartley. Essential provision is to avail themselves of the election procedure under the Taft-Hartley Act, and began a process of red baiting in the CIO unions. It was in this period that many of the union leaders that had been taken up by the Communist Party had been built up, touted as heroes of the American working class, who were nothing but opportunists, began to break with the Communist Party. Figures like Quill, Curran, many who had been placed in office and kept in office by the CP machine turned against the CP and were able effectively to do a real hatchet job on them because they had so completely discredited themselves during the period from the Hitler-Stalin Pact and all of the zigzags that they had undergone through the period of the war when they were became ultra-patriots in the post-war period when they, as they say, their concept was that the class struggle had been eliminated and alienated many of the militants. It was not the reaction alone that was sufficient to eliminate the CP from control of many of the unions in the CIO and some in the AFL, but the fact that the militants had turned against them during the whole previous period of their ultra-patriotism and subordination of the class struggle and of the civil rights struggle to the winning of the war. The Cold War of 1946 led, I will discuss that tomorrow when we take up the political aspect of these developments, led to the establishment of the East European states, the workers' states of Eastern Europe, and in this country, to the formation of the Progressive Party, initiated by the Stalinists, staffed by them, financed by them, by and large led by them, with Henry Wallace and Taylor as the presidential and vice presidential candidate. Now here again, we discussed how the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and the labor bureaucracy had diverted the movement of the CIO workers from 1934 through 1937, the movement towards independent working class political action back into the channels of the Democratic Party through such devices of the Labor's Nonpartisan League and the American Labor Party. Now here again, although the Communist Party was the target of the political attack by the administration and the trade union bureaucracy when they launched the Progressive Party, it was not on the basis of a class party, but on the same concept of people's frontism, which had dominated their policy since 1935, when the Comintern adopted its people's front line. And so the Progressive Party the unions, many of the unions they controlled. The constitution of the Progressive Party was so devised that unions as such would have no representation in the party. Union members could join as individuals, but not unions representing the membership of their organization, such as the practice of the Labour Party in Great Britain. And its program was a capitalist program. It didn't call for socialism. It called for capitalist reform. And the key main slogan was peace. And Wallace, he was the big peacemaker at that time, until the Korean War broke out, and then he came out and supported the Korean War, as happens to all such peacemakers. They're peacemakers until war breaks out. They're against war in general, but they always find some reason to be in support of the particular, the concrete war. There's always an exception they find which necessitates their supporting the concrete war, but